The views and opinions expressed here are those of the guests and are not the official position of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
One of the most remarkable aspects of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is its unique history. Throughout the world, great stories from faithful church members have only added to that history. This program shares some of these incredible stories of faith, perseverance, hope, and inspiration. You're listening to Legacy. I'm your host, Nathan Wright. Of the 136 sections in the Doctrine and Covenants, 65 of those sections, or nearly half, were given in Ohio from 1831 to 1837. It was in Kirtland, Ohio, that the Lord revealed the Word of Wisdom. Kirtland was also the site of the first Latter-day Temple. The time spent in Ohio was a great period of development and spiritual growth for the church. Listeners of Legacy will recognize not only the names, but also the voices of Jenny Lund and Mark Staker of the Church History Department. Mark and Jenny, thanks very much for being here. Welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
As a reminder, Mark visited with us previously about Harmony, Pennsylvania, and Jenny gave us some new insights about winter quarters. For those listeners who may be new to our show, will you two please give us a little background about yourself, Jenny, and then Mark?
Okay. I've worked for the Church History Department for about 24 years now, for many years at the Church History Museum, and more recently working with historic sites around the country.
Very good. Mark? I've worked for the Church History Department for about 17 years. Starting out as a curator at the Church History Museum and moving on to historic sites where I do research.
Good. Thank you. So today we are talking about Kirtland, Ohio. Let's start off with some of the recent happenings and research that's been going on there. Who wants to start?
Well, within the last decade, the church launched a major restoration effort at Kirtland, Ohio. A number of these historic sites had come into the church possession beginning in the 1950s. And they had been sites where visitors came. And then in the 1980s, there's some partial restorations that went on, including the one at the Whitney Store, which was actually an award-winning restoration project. But the reality was that we needed to take a much more aggressive approach to restoring these structures and putting them in the context of the community, particularly at Kirtland. And so beginning around in the late 1990s, we began working on this project, and the John Johnson home restoration was completed about 2000 or a little later, 2001, and then the Kirtland project in 2004, I believe.
Excellent. Mark, any insights on what's been happening?
The restoration was a real boon to the church, partly in terms of being able to preserve our heritage. Some of these buildings had begun to deteriorate, and so this gave an opportunity to bring them up to grade and preserve them. It also gave the opportunity to learn a lot of new information about our heritage as we got into the buildings and as we began to look through the documents to try to understand, you know, what really happened in Kirtland. It's a period of history that is important to Latter-day Saints, but we have partly neglected it in favor of other parts of our history. And so it's given us an opportunity to focus on what really happened there.
It was a few summers ago, the Mormon Tabernacle Choir was on tour and stopped off in Kirtland. And as I was wandering around, heard some visitors from I didn't know them or know where they were from, but they mentioned something about the difference between restoration and reconstruction. Was some of the structures we did actually reconstruction?
Yes. The Whitney store was a restoration. That means the building existed, or most of the building existed, and we were able to take off the later additions and put it back the way we believe it originally was. We were able to do the same thing with the Whitney home across the street. However, other buildings there are complete reconstructions. That means that there was nothing left other than some foundations buried under the ground. And that was one of the most interesting things we did here is the archaeology to find those foundations, which told us a lot about the buildings. One of those buildings, the sawmill, we weren't even looking for at the time. We were looking for the ashery and happened to stumble across the sawmill and came to realize what an important structure this was in that early history of Kirtland, that the church built this sawmill in order to be able to build the temple. And so we were able to reconstruct that as well, using the information we got from archaeology as well as information from other sawmills built in the area at the time period, other asheries built in the same time period. What was kind of typical for those kinds of industrial buildings?
The sawmill is an amazing structure. It's just so true to life.
One challenge we face with the ashery is that there's not a restored ashery anywhere in the world. And so we did the first one, and it took a lot of effort to figure out what would a building like this look like, how did it operate. We did something that no one else has done there.
How much time have you been able to spend back there, each of you?
Well, I think Mark spent quite a bit more time there because he worked the archaeology project and did some research. But because we work with historic sites, our work takes us to those sacred places.
Excellent. Let's go back now and talk about the history. Many events took place in both Kirtland and Hiram. Where are they in relation to each other? How close? And in Joseph Smith's time, how long would it take to get from one to the other?
Hiram's about 30 miles south of Kirtland, southeast of Kirtland, and it would take the better part of an afternoon. Joseph was able to get there. He held a conference in the morning on one day and was able to get there by nightfall. And so if you traveled fast, you could get there in a day.
Joseph came to Kirtland, and it was, I guess, not too long after that that the Lord commanded the saints to gather in Kirtland, or maybe it was before. I'm not sure of that exactly. But what was it about Kirtland that brought the church there?
Well, I think the command to gather to Kirtland had actually come before Joseph had come there. Joseph had called four missionaries to go to the Lamanites on the western borders, which would have been in the area of Missouri, where they eventually went. But on their way, they stopped in Kirtland. And Parley P. Pratt had previously come from that area around there and wanted to talk to his former preacher, Signe Rigdon. So his missionaries preached there, and they had tremendous success. And so there was a large core of members of the church there in Kirtland. And the Lord had then commanded Joseph to go to the Ohio. That's where the church was to go and to prosper and to be built up.
Where did Joseph and Emma live when they got to Kirtland? Did they actually have a house there?
They lived in quite a few different places. When they first arrived in Kirtland, Newell K. Whitney and his wife, Elizabeth Ann Whitney, invited Joseph and Emma to live with them. When we first imagined how this had taken place, we thought that they had a lot more space to offer than they did. It turns out that there was only one small bedroom, a 14-square-foot bedroom, on the main floor that the Whitney family had. And so when they offered that to Joseph and Emma, it was quite a sacrifice for them to give up their only bedroom. And the parents moved upstairs in a small half-story with the children and slept up there while Joseph and Emma remained on the main floor. They were there for a couple of weeks. After that, they moved to the Morley Farm, where the Lord had commanded in Revelation that the saints build a house where Joseph could translate. And so they lived there for a few months until September of 31, when Isaac Morley sold his farm so that he could go to Missouri. And then Joseph and Emma were without a home again. And at that point, John and Elsa Johnson invited them to go down and live with them in Hiram, Ohio, and that's how Joseph and Emma ended up in Hiram. There was a brief period when Joseph went to Missouri, but other than that, they were down there for a year's length of time, and they moved back up to stay with the Whitneys, and they stayed in the Whitney store. for a couple of years until they got their own home built up near the temple and lived there the rest of the time they were in Kirtland.
Do you have some favorite sites in Kirtland?
Well, there's nothing to compare with the Kirtland Temple, which is truly a magnificent building. It's when you think about these people who were really quite poor and challenged with building up their homes and farms and businesses, and then at the same time completing this structure, which for that area and time was really quite grand. It's really a beautiful building. I like to think of it in terms of a gem. It's just kind of the perfect building for that space and time.
One of my favorite sites is the Whitney Store for a number of reasons. That's where the School of the Prophets was held, and a lot of sacred experiences occurred there. A number of the revelations that we have in the Doctrine and Covenants were revealed in the Whitney Store. It also comes to symbolize consecration because Newell K. Whitney consecrated everything that he had gathered as a business owner to the church to build up the kingdom. And so for me, it has personal meaning because it represents what I'm about as a Latter-day Saint.
Thank you. Let's go back to the temple. Jenny, you mentioned that the hard times had hit everyone. It wasn't just members of the church, as I understand. And so here they are building this huge structure, one of a kind in the area. How did it all transpire?
Well, it's interesting that when Joseph first talked to the saints about building a temple, people were talking in terms of a log structure. That's kind of thought in people's minds. And Joseph says, no, this is the house of the Lord. This is must be built to last and to really kind of embody those things which the Lord would reveal there. And so the plan was then to build it out of this rubble stone and then to put a stucco exterior on the outside, which was originally scored so that it looked like brick. Today the building looks like just covered in white stucco, but originally it was scored so that it actually looked like stone, masonry. It looked like stone, a gray masonry building. And I can't remember, what color was the roof?
The roof was red.
The roof was red, really? And doors and woodwork
were
green.
The doors were an olive green. The exterior was a blue color. The tower was polychrome. We don't know exactly which colors, but a lot of different colors. The interior was a number of colors. Even the pulpits had red velvet over them. It was an elaborate structure.
Much different than what we're used to seeing temples anytime else.
That is, but in that time period, that kind of polychrome, many-colored effect was very, very popular and very high style. So it would have looked just beautiful to them. Today it would seem a little shocking to most of us.
As far as the construction itself, timbers, what's the right term that you would call this kind of a structure?
It was the framework was of heavy hewn timbers.
Okay.
Outside of that, they used rubble rock construction, which was covered by plaster.
Okay. I saw on a website some of the restoration as they redid stucco back in the 70s or whenever it was, and that would look really rather interesting. One traditional story that exists, I think, kind of widespread in the church is during the construction of the temple, the people were sacrificing so much that the sisters of the church took their china, ground it up, and used it as part of the plaster to make the walls shine. Can we verify that or tell us a little bit more about that story?
You know, that's really a great story. But when you go to look at it closely, you start to get a little dumbfounded. You say, well, why weren't any of the saints who were actually doing all this sacrificing, writing about it or noting it? They talked about other sacrifices they made for the temple, about how hard they worked and the money they donated, and yet none of them talked about it. So there is pottery or ceramic ware in the plaster of the temple. This was a technique which had been brought from Canada by a convert to the church named Artemus Millet. And it was a technique which made a building glimmer a little bit. in the sunshine, made a beautiful plaster. But where did that ceramic ware come from? Well, there are two accounts which tell us that the children in the community were hired to go around to people's garbage heaps and collect the broken pottery and ceramic ware to bring to the temple and to be mixed in the plaster. That story about the sisters donating their very best china, when we tried to track that one down, that actually came from a church member named Cecil McGavin, who was a historian, and he went to Ohio in the 1930s and interviewed a lot of residents there in the Kirtland area, trying to get stories about the Latter-day Saint occupation. And one of these stories that he picked up was this story about the sisters donating their china. When we looked at that evidence, however, the people he interviewed, the oldest people he interviewed, were not even alive at the time. They had been born 20 and 30 and 40 years later. And so they probably saw that that china in the and ceramic ware in the plaster and assumed that it had been donations. But it looks like the evidence leads toward it being broken china, because the saints are, of course, practical. And if you have broken dishware to donate, that's what you do.
Can someone give me a background on the Section 89 on the Word of Wisdom, which also took place in Kirtland?
When Joseph Smith arrived in Kirtland, he found a group of Latter-day Saints that, by and large, had belonged to a communal organization before, known as the Morley family. The Morley family had drawn on influences from around the region. Daniel Pratt, a relative of Parley and Orson Pratt, had founded a group of Owenites in the area that were religiously motivated, but adopted a lot of the communal ideas of the Owenite communal organization in the United States at that time. And they were interested in a good diet and living healthy. So their group apparently adopted a number of these principles, including avoiding drinking tea and coffee and using tobacco and alcohol. They also didn't eat pork and avoided meat in general. When Joseph Smith arrived, he didn't really address those issues other than to say that that he was going to eat pork, because he had grown up with that. He didn't have any inspiration on the subject per se, other than some commentary on how that idea of avoiding pork had developed. So the Latter-day Saints just continued to do whatever they had done before. Most appeared to have continued to smoke tobacco, including a lot of Joseph's own family members. We know that his brothers, for example, a number of them used tobacco, and he may well have himself. But as they met in the School of the Prophets in the Whitney Store, they began to explore a lot of religious issues, including health issues. One day, Joseph received a revelation on the subject. As he received that revelation and dictated it, he went into the other room where the School of the Prophets was being held and read that revelation to the men in that room. And all of the men there were smoking their pipes but one. I've forgotten the number, 20, 21 men, all smoking their pipes. He read the revelation to them. As soon as they heard it, they stood up and threw their pipes into the fireplace and gave up tobacco. And so that was the initial attempt to live the Word of Wisdom. It took some time before the Latter-day Saints became good at doing that.
One of the traditional stories of that is Joseph's wife, Emma, coming into the room and finding the spittoons and the mess and everything. Is that any part of the history, or is that just another...
That's Brigham Young's understanding from other individuals. He wasn't there at the time that the revelation was received, but that probably also played a role, that Emma was concerned about the use of tobacco. But that doesn't explain all of the different answers that they received. They were concerned about health in general and trying to live closer to God.
Excellent. Thank you. There were so many revelations that happened, as we've talked about. I've been looking at the Earl Olson document as he chronicles where the revelations came and what the circumstance was. And there's a small picture of what is considered the Kirtland revelations. Tell me about how these revelations were compiled, how they were received.
You know, I think one of the things about revelation is Latter-day Saints today kind of assume it's a solitary activity, but at least for Joseph, the revelations typically came when he was in a meeting with other people, or when he was translating the scriptures, and usually had at least a scribe with him. Sometimes there was a whole room full of people, and a few of those people left a witness. Parley P. Pratt talked about how he could dictate sentences, yet just dictate a phrase and wait for the scribe to write it down, dictate another phrase, wait for the scribe, and yet the entire thing was coherent when he was finished. Another witness talked about the change in Joseph's countenance when he was overcome by the Spirit and was in the process of receiving a revelation. Mark, do you have other things to add?
The Kirtland Revelation book that you mentioned is one of the books where they collected these revelations, kept track of them because they consider them sacred. The Joseph Smith Papers Project, the scholars working on that project right now have gone through that book. They've gone through the Book of Commandments and Revelations book, which was another one that collected those revelations, and they've transcribed those and are making that information available to researchers and to members and others interested in them.
There's a comment in this document by B.H. Roberts, who said some of the early revelations first published in the Book of Commandments were revised by the prophet himself in the way of correcting errors made by the scribes and publishers. Some additional clauses were inserted to throw increased light on the subjects treated in the revelations, and paragraphs added to make the principles or instructions apply to officers not in the church at the time some of the earlier revelations were given. So it sounds like they weren't immune from a little bit of adjustment.
No, they weren't. And you have to remember the principle that revelation and understanding comes line upon line. And the prophet would receive a revelation and produce it in his own words. And as another revelation came in the future, that might improve his understanding a little bit. I think one of the keys for me to help understand these changes is in the scriptures is that the Doctrine and Covenants was really more like they thought of it sort of like a manual, like we might think of the Church Handbook of Instructions. And as greater light and knowledge came, then they went back and made some changes. A good example of that is Section 20, which did not originally mention deacons because the role of the deacon hadn't been revealed yet. And so it's in Kirtland where that comes, and so then that's later added to Section 20. So that's not really going back, and that's not going back and editing for any purposes of fraud or to deceive anyone. It was going back and editing so that the manual, which would guide the church day to day, would be in the right order, so the order of the church could go forth. And when you look at the original Doctrine and Covenants, it seems to be organized as a manual, with Section 20, which is the Constitution of the Church, appears first, and then it's followed by Revelations, which just kind of lay out the order, a number on priesthood. There seems to be an order to the to the Revelations. Today we see them in chronological order, more or less.
You talk about line upon line, and this was something the prophet Joseph got to deal with as well. He was early on in Kirtland, as I understand, and some woman came up to him claiming revelation for the church, and he himself had to ask God if this was the way it was supposed to work. Any insights on that?
That woman turns out to be Laura Hubble. We've learned a little bit more about her. She was a young mother, left her children home with her husband, and went to join the Latter-day Saints in Kirtland. And she wanted to be a teacher within the community. We don't know if that meant priesthood ordination or a teacher in terms of gospel instruction. They didn't really have Sunday school. They didn't have a Sunday school organization then, so we don't quite know the role that she sought. But there was some conflict there in terms of what kind of influence would she have and what kind of role would she play.
Very interesting. Let's talk about a little bit of the persecution that took place. It seems like to me that Hiram, being so far removed from Kirtland, would be a safer place for the prophet and his family. Why did, do we know why there was so much activity out there while he was living at the Johnson home?
Today we tend to focus on Kirtland as a gathering place for Latter-day Saints. When Joseph and Emma moved to Hiram, Ohio, there were more Latter-day Saints in that county than anywhere else in
the
church.
See, and I think that's what is confusing, at least to me, is we assume that everybody was still back in Kirtland, and Joseph and his family only moved out here for a little peace and quiet.
You know, the Kirtland Saints, by and large, had gone to Missouri, and so the church was really growing in Portage County, in Hiram, but in Mantua, where the Lorenzo and Eliza Snow lived, King Follett down in Schallersville and his family and relatives, and many other Latter-day Saints that you might recognize their names lived within this region. So it was a good place for Joseph to set up headquarters for the church. It was a place where people could gather and listen to him preach. He preached at the Johnson home, at the local schoolhouse, and in other places around the area. And so it was really a place where there were a lot of Latter-day Saints.
And the mob that I think I'm referring to was the night they actually pulled him out of bed, tarred and feathered, and this was a situation that caused some exposure to some of his family members.
That was a traumatic event, of course. It was a defining moment for Joseph. I think that he realized after that how vulnerable he was, and that it was only through the protection of the Lord that he would survive as long as the Lord needed him. There are a lot of factors involved in trying to understand what happened that night. Why did people feel that they needed to go and try to kill Joseph? Because it ultimately, for a number of those individuals, it was an attempted murder. They were out there trying to kill Joseph. And there were a lot of different factors. I mentioned that there were a lot of Latter-day Saints in that area, and many of them were gathering together during that month and the previous month, discussing going to Missouri. They wanted to gather with the saints in Zion. And they had relatives, family members and friends who wanted to keep them from going. And some of these people were anxious to come up with a solution to do that. At the same time, they were receiving a lot of new revelations. 17 revelations were received in Hiram. Many of those had already come. And the church was becoming a different organization than it had been when they joined. When most of these people in Portage County joined the church, it was you had the Book of Mormon, which had new doctrines and new understanding. But the church itself was very familiar to them because it organizationally and a lot of the teachings still drew from what they were very familiar with. Now you have a shift in understanding that made some people upset or uncomfortable. And these things combined together with perhaps other factors as well that influenced a number of individuals. We don't know exactly how many, but eyewitnesses say at least 20. Some say as many as 50 men joined together to attack Joseph Smith and Sidney Rigdon. They attacked them in the middle of the night. It looks like it was towards morning time when they arrived. And some of the men attacked Sidney Rigdon. And the rest went to Joseph Smith and pulled them both out of bed and took them down the road a ways to where they tried to pour aquafortis in their mouths. Aquafortis is nitric acid, which would have killed them if they had been successful. And as a matter of fact, Heber C. Kimball and a couple of other individuals say that Joseph Smith died during that attack, that he had an out-of-body experience where he was able to look down upon himself, but went back in to his body and continued to go through the experience and eventually recovered. So it was quite traumatic. As a matter of fact, we typically think of Joseph as having gotten a tooth chipped that night because one of Joseph's associates said that his tooth was broken, but it was broken out. There are a number of eyewitnesses who say that he was missing a tooth as a result of that event. He had a little bald spot that he combed his hair to hide for at least years after, if not for the rest of his life. And his side was severely injured in the process that years later he still remarked on that injury affecting him. So it was a very traumatic experience for him that nearly took his life if it wasn't for the protection of the Lord.
It just seems so interesting, the polar opposites that Kirtland provides looking back, with the revelations and the manifestations on this side and so much of the persecution and the falling away on the other side. What can we learn from all of it?
Kirtland's a significant period of church history. I think that we learn a number of things from the experience. One is that the Lord watches out for his saints, that he is concerned about our well-being and our welfare. He provides revelations through his prophet to give us direction, guidance, and comfort. But we also learn that there is opposition in all things. And Joseph was no stranger to opposition. He encountered it from the very beginning of the restoration, but a lot of his followers who joined the church and gathered in Kirtland, this was a new experience for them, and so it was really a learning experience for the entire church. There were, for example, serious debates as to how they would respond to opposition. They expected a mob to come in to Kirtland to attack the members, and they organized in small defensive groups. So these were real struggles as to how do we respond to persecution, and they needed to sort that out in Kirtland.
So as far as the church's presence there today, if a visitor wants to go, what, Jenny, can you tell us exactly what they can expect to find?
Well, a visit to Kirtland today, we recommend that you start at the LDS Visitor Center, which is down in what's called the Flat, kind of at the bottom of the hill. And there you can watch a movie that gives you a really good overview of Kirtland's history, and then visit a number of the historic sites. The Whitney home, where Joseph and Emma first went. The Whitney store, where they later lived and where Joseph received quite a number of revelations. See the ashery, which was Newell K. Whitney had built that ashery or was operating that ashery, owned it, and he consecrated that to the United Firm so that that could help pay for publishing efforts and buying of land and the building of the temple and the sawmill, which is also another part of that temple story. Not too far from there, about a mile down the road, visitors can also stop at the Morley Farm, which has a couple of historic markers which tell some of the experiences there. And then sort of as the culmination of the visit, if they drive or walk up the hill to the temple, which is really kind of the crowning part of that visit to Hiram, or visit to Kirtland, excuse me. But you can't miss also a visit to Hiram, which takes about 30 or 40 minutes to drive it. And there are, I think, a lot of saints don't go there because it's so far away. But that's the building where we think more revelations were given than any other single place in the history of the church. It's a place of great revelation and this great tragedy that happened to the prophet in the tarring and feathering. So that one should not be missed either.
Any parting thoughts from either?
When I think about Kirtland and try and put it in the big picture, the way I like to think of it is the experience is in New York are really kind of the cradle of the Restoration or the infancy of the church. And I like to think of Kirtland in the terms of the schooling, the school years, the learning the basics, the very essential revelations starting to be given. People make a lot of stumbles as we try and work through what God's plan is for his kingdom upon the earth. But it's and then it's all crowned by the temple there on the hillside. So I like to think in terms of that schooling, and then moving on to some of the other experiences. I guess maybe Missouri's the adolescence, or
perhaps,
and Nauvoo the college years.
For me, I see that Joseph Smith, throughout his life, struggled to make sense of Kirtland. Even the very last night of his life, as he lay on the floor in Carthage, sleeping, he dreamt about the Kirtland experience, and he described it as a vision where he was back in Kirtland looking over his farm. His barn was in shambles. The doors are missing, the floors up, and people are fighting over it. And Joseph then leaves that, and he wakes up, and that describing that vision, he leaves it without an explanation. And Willard Richards records that, and we're left to try to make sense of that. But one of the things that I've have drawn for myself out of that experience is that Kirtland didn't quite end up the way Joseph had hoped it would. He hoped to create Zion. He sought to establish a bank there that he thought would help do away with the poor among them, that would help unite them as a people and help them become one. And he failed to establish Zion in Kirtland, and he couldn't quite make sense of that over time, or at least from my understanding, he didn't make sense of why he failed. The members weren't ready to follow him fully. There are a number of individuals, Brigham Young among them, perhaps the most consistent, who said that the saints couldn't trust Joseph in financial matters. They wouldn't follow him as he sought to establish this bank. They couldn't commit themselves fully. And because they couldn't all get behind the prophet in every aspect of their lives, they failed to establish what they ultimately wanted to accomplish. And I think that Joseph wrestled with that for the rest of his life. How could they have done that better? And I think that he tried to adjust his approach in Nauvoo because of that. And so I think that Kirtland serves as a model for each one of us, a negative model, if you will, of the failure to establish Zion because we don't give ourselves wholly to the effort. And I think that we can draw a lot of details from that experience that help piece that together in our lives.
Thank you very much. We've been talking about Kirtland today with Jenny Lund and Mark Staker of the Church History Department. Thank you both for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.